Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Women, Food, and God, An Unexpected Path to Almost Everything, by Janine Roth, narrated by the author.
Prologue, The World on Our Plates. 80 hungry women are sitting in a circle with bowls of cold tomato vegetable soup. They are glowering at me, furious. It is lunchtime on the third day of the retreat. During these daily eating meditations, each woman approaches the buffet table, lines up to be served, takes her seat in the circle, and waits until we all sit down to eat. The process is agonizingly slow, 15 minutes or so, especially if food is your drug of choice. Although the retreat is going well, and many people here have had life-changing insights, at this moment, no one cares. They don't care about stunning breakthroughs or having 90 pounds to lose or whether God exists. They want to be left alone with their food, period. They want me to take my fancy ideas about the link between spirituality and compulsive eating and go away. It is one thing to be conscious about food in the meditation hall, and another to be sitting in the dining room, refraining from taking even one bite until the entire group has been served. Also, I've asked that silence be observed, so there are no frissons of laughter or chatty how are yous to distract attention from hunger or lack of it, since not everyone is hungry. The retreat is based on a philosophy I've developed over the past 30 years, that our relationship to food is an exact microcosm of our relationship to life itself. I believe we are walking, talking expressions of our deepest convictions. Everything we believe about love, fear, transformation, and God is revealed in how, when, and what we eat. When we inhale Reese's peanut butter cups when we're not hungry, we are acting out an entire world of hope or hopelessness, of faith or doubt, of love or fear. If we are interested in finding out what we actually believe, not what we think, not what we say, but what our souls are convinced is the bottom line truth about life and afterlife, we need go no further than the food on our plates. God is not just in the details. God is also in the muffins, the fried sweet potatoes, and the tomato vegetable soup. God, however we define him or her, is on our plates. Which is why 80 women and I are sitting in a circle with cold vegetable soup. I look around the room. Photographs of flowers, intricate close-ups of a red dahlia, the golden edges of a white rose, are hung on the wall. A bouquet of peach gladiolas is splayed so extravagantly on a side table that it looks as if it is prancing at the prom in its finery. Then I begin noticing the faces of my students. Marjorie, a psychologist in her 50s, is playing with her spoon and doesn't meet my eyes. A 20-year-old gymnast named Patricia is wearing black tights and a lemon-colored tank top. Her tiny body sits like an origami bird on her cushion, delicate, perfectly erect. On her plate is a handful of sprouts and a fistful of salad. That's all. I look to my right and see Anna, a surgeon from Mexico City, biting one of her lips and tapping her fork on the plate impatiently. There are three pieces of bread with thick slabs of butter on her plate. A bit of salad, no soup, no vegetables. Her food says, "Fuck you, Janine. I don't have to play this ridiculous game. Watch me binge the second I get the chance." I nod at her as if to say, "Yup, I understand how hard it is to slow down." I take a quick glance around the rest of the room at faces, at plates. The air is thick with resistance to this eating meditation. And since I am the one who makes the rules, I am also the one at whom the fury is directed. Getting between people and their food is like standing in front of a speeding train. The act of being stopped in compulsive behavior is not exactly met with good cheer. Anyone want to say anything before we begin? I ask. Silence. Then, blessings on our food and all that made it possible. The rain, the sun, the people who grew it, brought it here, served it here, I say. I can hear Amanda, who is sitting to my right, taking a deep breath at the sound of the prayer. Across the room, Zoe nods her head as if to say, "Oh, right. The earth, the sun, the rain, glad they're here." But not everyone is grateful to take one more second to do anything but eat. Louisa, in her bright red running suit, sighs and grunts an almost indiscernible, "Oh, for God's sakes, can we please get on with this?" She looks as if she's ready to kill me. Humanely, of course, and only with the slightest bit of suffering, but still. "Now take some time and notice what you put on your plate," I say. "Notice if you were hungry when you chose the food. If you weren't physically hungry, was there another kind of hunger present? And looking at your plates, decide what you want to eat first and take a few bites. Notice how the food feels in your mouth. If it tastes like you thought it would taste. If it does what you thought it would do." 3-4 minutes pass amid the symphony of eating sounds. Rustling, chewing, swallowing, clinking. I notice that Izzy, a 6'2" willowy woman from France, is looking out the window and seems to have forgotten that we're eating. But most people are holding the plates up to their mouths so they can get the bites in faster. Lori, a 35-year-old CEO of a Boston mortgage company, raises her hand. "I'm not hungry, but I want to be. I want to eat anyway." "Why is that?" I ask. "Because it looks good, and it's here right now. It's the best comfort in town. What's wrong with wanting comfort from food?" "Not a thing," I say. "Food is good and comfort is good. Except that when you're not hungry and you want comfort, food is only a temporary palliative. Why not address the discomfort directly?" "It's too hard to address things directly, too painful, and there isn't any end to it. And if it's going to be endlessly painful, then at least I have food," she says. "So you figure that the best you can get out of life is cold vegetable soup?" When she talks again, her voice is quivering. "It's the only true comfort I have, and I'm not going to deprive myself of it." A tear jogs down her right cheek, hovers on her top lip. Heads nod in assent. A wave of murmurs passes around the circle. Lori says, "The thing we do here, waiting in silence until everyone gets their food, reminds me of what it was like to eat dinner in our family. My mother was drinking. My father was furious, and no one was talking. It was horrible." "What were you feeling during those times?" I ask. "Lonely, miserable, like I was born into the wrong family. I wanted to escape, but there was no place to go. I felt trapped. And this feels the same way. Like all of you are crazy, and I'm trapped here with a bunch of loonies." More head nods, more murmurs. A woman from Australia looks at me defiantly, her black waist-length hair brushing the edge of the soup bowl. I imagine she is thinking that Lori is right, and can she get a ride to the airport in 15 minutes? But right here, right now, in the center of this wound, I've been abandoned and betrayed by who and what really matters, and what I've got left is food, is where the link between food and God exists. It marks the moment when we gave up on ourselves, on change, on life. It marks the place where we are afraid. It marks the feelings we won't allow ourselves to feel, and in so doing, keeps our lives constricted and dry and stale. In that isolated place, it is a short step to the conclusion that God, where goodness and healing and love exist, abandoned us, betrayed us, or is a supernatural version of our parents. Our practice at the retreats of working through this despair is not one of exerting will or conjuring up faith, but being curious, gentle, and engaged with the cynicism, the hopelessness, the anger. I ask Lori if she can make room for the part of her that feels trapped and lonely. She says no, she can't. She says she just wants to eat. I ask her if she's willing to consider the possibility that this has nothing to do with food. She says no, she can't. She is staring at me with a look of grim determination that says, keep out, go away, not interested. Her eyes are narrow. Her mouth is tight. The room feels as if the air has been sucked out of it. People have stopped breathing. They are staring at me, at Lori, waiting. I am wondering, I say, why you are so intent on keeping me out. It seems as if there is a part of you bent on isolation, maybe even destruction. She puts down her spoon, which she has been holding in midair, and stares at me. Have you given up? I ask. It's a risky question because it plunges right into the despair, but I ask it since she has been fighting with me for the past 3 days, and I am concerned about her leaving the retreat in a state of stony withdrawal. When did the determination not to believe in anything ever again set in? She inhales sharply, sits without speaking for a few minutes. I look around the room. Suzanne, a mother of 3 young children, is crying. Victoria, a psychiatrist from Michigan, is waiting, watching, absorbed in what is happening. I've wanted to die since I was about 10, Lori says quietly. Can you make room for the 10-year-old, I ask, the one who didn't see any way out of the hopeless situation she found herself in? Very gently, see if you can sense the hurt itself. Lori nods her head. I think I can do that, she says quietly. I ask her to do this, not so that she can comfort her inner child. I don't believe in inner children. I do believe that there are frozen places in ourselves, undigested pockets of pain that need to be recognized and welcomed so that we can contact that which has never been hurt or wounded or hungry. Although the work we do at the retreat is often experienced as therapeutic, it is not therapy. Unlike therapy, it is not designed to bolster self-esteem, which was created in reaction to our past. The work at the retreat is designed to reveal that which is beyond self-esteem, unconditioned by our past. Our personality and its defenses, one of which is our emotionally charged relationship to food, are a direct link to our spirituality. They are the breadcrumbs leading us home. Lori says, I don't know what just happened, but suddenly I have no desire to eat the soup. I say, it seems as if there is something even better than food, touching what you considered untouchable and viscerally discovering that you are bigger than your pain. She nods her head and smiles for the first time in 3 days. Life doesn't seem so bad at this moment. Saying out loud how bad I thought it was when I was 10 makes it seem not so bad now. I guess what happens is that I can feel the 10-year-old and how big her sadness was without totally becoming her. That's a good thing. The simple fact that her pain can be touched and that it won't destroy her means that all is not lost or hopeless or unredeemable. I nod my head and ask if she wants to keep talking to me. She says, I think this is enough for now. I ask people to pick up their silverware and take a few more bites, noticing what they want to eat, how it tastes, how they feel. A few minutes later, Nell, a student at the retreats for 7 years, raises her hand. I am not hungry anymore, but I suddenly realize that I'm afraid to push the food away. Why, I ask. Because, and she starts to cry, because I realize I am not broken and that you will be angry at me if you know. Why would I be angry at you, I ask. Because you'd see who I really am and you wouldn't like it. What would I see? Vitality, a lot of energy, determination, strength. Wow, I say. And what wouldn't I like about that? I wouldn't need you then, and you would be threatened by that. Who are you taking me to be? Anyone you know who was threatened by how gorgeous you are? Nell starts to laugh. Hi, Mom, she says. The room erupts in a wave of laughter. She was so depressed, Nell says. And if I was just myself, that was too much for her. I needed to shut down the bigness. I needed to be as broken as she was. Otherwise, she'd reject me, and that was unacceptable. What's happening in your body, Nell, I ask. It feels like a fountain of color, she says. It's as if I am streaming with vivid hues of red, green, gold, black, streaking in my chest, my arms, my legs. Okay, let's stop here for a minute, I say. I look around the room. Anna, who'd wanted to tell me to fuck off, is crying. Camille, who has looked bored since the retreat started, seems utterly absorbed in what's happening. The group attention is riveted by what Nell is saying about the need to be broken. They can relate to the belief that if they keep themselves wounded and damaged, they will be loved. I look at Nell and say, when you stop and let yourself feel what's being offered to you, it's never, ever what you thought it would be. You go from being afraid to being a fountain in 3 minutes. Nell says, it feels as if this quiet, calm space has been waiting for me to come back to it. Like it's been here all my life, like it's more me than anything else. And then Nell stands up and looks around the room. She pulls her chair aside and says, listen to this, girls. I am not broken. More laughter. Then Nell continues. This process amazes me. First, I had to deal with the food thing. I really did have to stop using food to comfort myself. Otherwise, I felt too crazy, and there was no time for this spiritual stuff. Then when my eating calmed down, I had to at least allow myself to feel the feelings of brokenness. That was tough. That was the part where I just had to believe what you were saying, Janine, that my resistance to the pain was worse than the pain. But to actually feel that I am not broken, I can hardly explain what that is like. It's like being a piece of holiness. It's like saying that goodness is not just for everyone else. It's also for me. It is me. Since it's almost time for the next session to begin in the meditation hall, I ask people to check in with their hunger levels, to rate themselves on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being hungry and 10 being full, and to eat accordingly. We'll meet down in the meditation hall in 30 minutes, I say, standing up from my seat. As I am about to walk out the door, a woman named Marie grabs my hand and says, I just have to say one thing to the group. Is that okay? I nod my head, bracing myself for what's coming. Marie has been a skeptic since the retreat began. She sat in the sessions glaring at me with her arms folded across her chest as if to say, prove it to me, honey. Prove that this food thing is anything more than just shutting my mouth. After each talk I've given, she's challenged me, confronted me. Yesterday, she told me she was sorry she ever came. This is just AFCO, she said, and I'm tired of it. I just want to lose the damn weight and be done with it. What's AFCO, I asked. Another fucking growth opportunity, Marie answered. I laughed so hard I started snorting. I'm sorry for laughing, I said, but it seems as if AFCOs have gotten a bad rap. Maybe you'll find that this retreat opens you in ways you never imagined. I doubt it, she answered, and stomped away. her loose ponytail of curly red hair bobbing as her body receded in the distance. "Now in the dining room," Marie says, "it just occurred to me that everything we believe about our lives is right here. The whole world is on these plates." "Amen, sister," I say. Before stepping out the door, I bend down to Marie's ear and quietly say, "Let's hear it for AFGOS." On my way to the meditation hall, I am once again aware that the entire retreat could take place in the dining room, that what we believe about food and eating is an exquisite reflection of all our beliefs. As soon as the food comes out, the feelings come out. As soon as the feelings come out, there is an inevitable recognition of the self-inflicted violence and suffering that fuel any obsession. And on the heels of that recognition comes the willingness to engage with and unwind the suffering rather than be its prisoner. The exquisite paradox of this engagement is that when the suffering is fully allowed, it dissolves. Weight loss occurs easily, naturally. And without the self-inflicted pain and the stories about what is wrong, what's left is what was there before they began, our connection to meaning and to that which we find holy. In 1978, I led my first group for compulsive eaters. At the initial meeting, I was 50 pounds overweight, and due to a misunderstanding with a hairdresser friend who'd given me a permanent, was sporting a set of rollers in my hair. Months earlier, a few hours away from killing myself after gaining 80 pounds in 2 months, I'd made the radical decision to stop dieting and eat what my body wanted. Since adolescence, I'd gained and lost over 1,000 pounds. I'd been addicted to amphetamines for 4 years and to laxatives for 2 years. I'd thrown up, spit up, fasted, and tried every diet possible, from the all grape nuts diet to the one hot fudge sundae a day diet to Atkins, Stillman, and Weight Watchers. I'd been anorexic, spending almost 2 years weighing 80 pounds, and I'd been quite overweight, mostly overweight. My closet was stuffed with 8 different sizes of pants, dresses, and blouses. Crazed with self-loathing and shame, I vacillated between wanting to destroy myself and wanting to fix myself with the next best promise of losing 30 pounds in 30 days. By that first dollar a session group, I'd been eating what my body wanted for a few months. I'd lost a few pounds, a major accomplishment for someone who believed that she'd be living in diet hell until her last breath, and it was slowly dawning on me that my relationship with food had affected every other part of my life. Those women who did not run screaming in the opposite direction when they realized that the overweight woman with rollers in her hair was, no kidding, the leader of the group, met with me weekly for 2 years as we explored the role food was playing in our lives. Until my first book, Feeding the Hungry Heart, was published in 1982, and I began teaching all over the country, in Alaska, Minnesota, Florida, New York, I worked with hundreds more women in weekly groups. Women who swore that they'd always need to lock their food in their kitchen cabinets and hide the key were suddenly able to eat one of something, one bowl, one piece, one bite. Women who had never been able to lose weight were suddenly finding their clothes too baggy, their waistbands too loose. Within a year after I'd stopped dieting, I'd reached my natural weight where I've remained for 3 decades. But more than the new body size, it was the lightness of being that enthralled me. Although I didn't quite understand the connection between trusting myself around food and trusting less tangible hungers for rest and contact and meaning, the relationship with food became the lens through which I began to see almost everything. Zen master Shunryu Suzuki Roshi said that enlightenment was following one thing all the way to the end. And I soon suspected that if I tracked the impulse to eat, when I wasn't hungry to its core, I'd find every single thing I believed about loving, living, and dying right there in that moment, which, following the relationship with food to the end, pretty much describes how I've spent the last 32 years. When I offered my first 6-day retreat in May of 1999, it was supposed to be a one-off event. I wanted to bring the twin passions of my life together, my work with eating and my years of meditation and spiritual inquiry. I'd meditated since 1974, lived in ashrams and monasteries, and was an ongoing student of the Diamond Approach, a non-denominational teaching that uses psychology as a bridge to spirituality. I still cringed when I heard the word God and the word spiritual evoked a vision of piety and austerity that did not match, this would be an understatement, my vast collection of nubby sweaters and honey-colored boots. I still had about a dozen moments of neurosis per day, but I also had more moments of contentment and freedom than I ever imagined possible for a formerly fat girl from Queens. I wanted everyone to know what I knew, have what I had. Still, I was stunned at what happened. It wasn't the stories about binging or dieting or fasting I'd heard. It wasn't the tales of abuse or trauma. I'd heard most of them before. No, what shocked me was that after years of working with compulsive eating, I'd been treating it as a psychological and physical problem. And although it was both of those, I suddenly saw that it was also a doorway into a blazing inner universe. After the first retreat, the students wanted to come back. They wanted to do it again. They reminded me of the afternoon I saw a full eclipse of the sun in Antigua. My husband and I were standing in the ocean with dozens of other people, wearing dark plastic glasses so that our eyes wouldn't get burned by the sun. We watched as the moon completely covered the sun, and we stood speechless in enchanted darkness. As the light slowly returned, someone yelled to the moon, "Again! Do it again!" Since we had an advantage over the moon, we could do it again. We did. And we still are. As I've taught the retreats, I've learned that each of us has a basic view of reality and God that we act out every day in our relationship with our families, our friends, our food. It doesn't matter whether we believe in one God, many gods, or no God. Anyone who breathes and thinks and experiences has beliefs about God. And since mothering is our first pre-verbal template for an existence in which we feel welcomed or rejected, loved or abandoned, many of us have fused our relationship with our mothers with our concepts of God. Whether we are aware of those early experiences or believe in pre-verbal templates does not alter the truth. Our daily lives, from the mundane to the sublime, from our reactions to sitting in traffic to our responses to the death of someone we love, are expressions, outpicturings of our deepest beliefs. To discover what you really believe, pay attention to the way you act and to what you do when things don't go the way you think they should. Pay attention to what you value. Pay attention to how and on what you spend your time, your money, and pay attention to the way you eat. You will quickly discover if you believe the world is a hostile place and that you need to be in control of the immediate universe for things to go smoothly. You will discover if you believe there's not enough to go around and that taking more than you need is necessary for survival. You will find out if you believe that being quiet is unbearable and that being alone means being lonely, if feeling your feelings means being destroyed, if being vulnerable is for sissies, or if opening to love is a big mistake. And you will discover how you use food to express each one of these core beliefs. The retreats now take place twice a year. And many of those first students having worked through their painful eating and lost weight, are still coming as a way, as they call it, to come home to themselves. Introductions, or in this case, prologues, are supposed to tell you who the book is written for and why you should read it. I'm probably not the best person to address these questions, because it seems to me that every single person has a shtick with food, and therefore everyone should read this book. Everyone who eats, everyone who wants to know why they can't stop eating, everyone who wants to use what they most want to get rid of, their addictions, their uncomfortable feelings, their unquestioned beliefs about their own limitations, as a path to what they most want more of, unruffled peace, everyday holiness, and ease of being in body, mind, and heart, should read this book. Also, anyone who has ever wondered about the meaning of life and/or questioned or felt abandoned by God. Did I just include all living beings? Probably, but as I said, I'm not objective in these matters, having spent 2/3 of my life astonished at the power and implications of the relationship with food. Here now is almost every single thing I know about using eating as a doorway to freedom from suffering, the demystification of weight loss, and the luminous presence that so many call God. Part 1. Principles. Chapter 1. About God. I turned to Hostess Snowballs the same year I gave up on God. I was 11 years old and had been praying nightly for thick hair and a boyfriend, but mostly for my parents to stop screaming at each other. After a year, nothing had changed. I'd heard about God from 2 sources: The Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston, and my friend Janie Delahunty, who wrote letters to him during social studies class. After I saw what God did to those Egyptians, I was positive he could give my parents a lesson or two on family peace. And when Janie described a God who read her letters and answered her prayers, I began praying too, but couldn't bring myself to write. Years later, in Children's Letters to God, a child wrote, this is a paraphrase, "Dear God, I love my family, but I wonder if you tried out anyone else before you sent me to them." I didn't like praying. I didn't like getting down on my knees and talking to the air. It felt too much like begging for love that I already knew I couldn't have. When my prayers weren't answered, I felt ashamed for believing I could be saved. I decided that God saw something in my cells that was unredeemable and that I was on my own. At 11, I felt like a raw nerve, as if the fact that I took up space at the red formica table was the reason for the hatred between my parents and their violence toward each other. They threw things, left the house, stayed away for hours or days. My mother looked like a blonde Sophia Loren. My brother looked like he belonged on Leave It to Beaver. But I had a moon face, stringy hair, and ankles as thick as piano stools. Even Robert Grady, who smelled like dirty socks, wouldn't pick me to dance with him at our 6th grade party. Enter food. The sight of a Hostess Snowball turned the world into a riot of color. The fluffy, pristine mound of marshmallow sprinkled with coconut, the promise of the chocolate cake inside, and then, oh then, the cloud of white icing. For the time it took to eat 4 or 6 snowballs, my hair was curly, my legs were as long as Maddie Isaac's, and my parents gazed adoringly at each other during picnics at Lake George, where we ate egg salad sandwiches with the crust cut off. I turned to food for the same reasons that people turn to God. It was my sigh of ecstasy, my transport to heaven, my concrete proof that relief from the pain of everyday life was possible. Then it would be gone. The cellophane packages would be empty, the bits of coconut stuck in my teeth, and I'd convince myself that the reason I didn't have parents who held hands at parades was because I was fat. And so I started dieting the same year I started binging. Dieting gave me a purpose. Binging gave me relief from the relentless attempt to be someone else. For almost two decades, the suffering I felt about anything, my parents' marriage, my boyfriend Sheldon's death, my chubby moon face, was expressed in my relationship with food. Overeating was my way to punish and shame myself. Each time I gained weight, each time I failed at a diet, I proved to myself that my deepest fear was true. I was pathetic and doomed, and I didn't deserve to live. I could have expressed this despair through drugs or shoplifting or alcohol, but I chose chocolate instead. Dieting was like praying. It was a plaintive cry to whoever was listening. I know I am fat. I know I am ugly. I know I am undisciplined. But see how hard I try. See how violently I restrict myself, deprive myself, punish myself. Surely there must be a reward for those who know how horrible they are. And precisely because dieting and binging were the main ways I was expressing my despair, the consequences of not dieting or binging were staggering. Making the decision to stop dieting was like committing heresy, like breaking a vow that was never supposed to be broken. It was like saying, "You were wrong, God. You were wrong, Mom. I am worth saving." And somehow by deciding that I was no longer going to collude with a belief in my own degradation, something I never would have called me showed up. The presence of loveliness, the awareness of kindness, and the unmistakable knowledge that I belonged here. I had no name for this kindness. I didn't believe in God or mystical experiences, but there was no denying that I was having the direct experience of a nameless something that was bigger than my mind, my childhood, my stories of what was wrong and right. The only way I can explain this even now is say that my suffering reached a critical mass of desperation. Either I was going to kill myself, or a completely different way of living was going to be revealed. And while I realized that in many cases human suffering does not lead to revelation, in my case, for some reason, it did. After that initial opening, it took years of questioning my old beliefs, years of spiritual and scientific exploration to make my way to a broader understanding of the presence that most people call God, but it was the pain of my relationship with food that opened the door. I don't believe in the God with long white hair and X-ray vision that favors some people, some countries, some religions, and not others. I don't believe in the sky dweller, the knower of all things, the granter of prayers. But I do believe in the world beyond appearances, and that there is so much we can't see or touch or know just by looking. And I do believe, because I have experienced it again and again, that the world beyond appearances is as real as a chair, a dog, a teapot. And I believe in love and beauty. I believe that every single person has something they find beautiful and that they truly love. The smell of their child's hair, the silence of a forest, their lover's crooked grin, their country, their religion, their family. And I believe that if you follow this love all the way to its end, if you start with the thing you find most beautiful, and trace its perfume back to its essence, you will perceive an intangible presence, a swath of stillness that allows the thing you love to be visible, like the openness of the sky reveals the presence of the moon. I don't believe in the God that most people call God, but I do know that the only definition of God that makes any sense is one that uses this human life and its suffering, the very things we believe we need to hide or fix, as a path to the heart of love itself, which is why the relationship with food is a perfect doorway. While I realize that some people find the word God explosive and potentially divisive, and that others have a deeply satisfying relationship with God, I use the word in this book because it evokes a vast expanse that we cannot penetrate with our minds, although we can know it through silence or poetry or simply sensing what is always here. And because pairing food with God fizzles the mind, the two seem as unrelated as titanium computers and scarlet peonies. All that you believe about food and God can fall away. And in the space of not knowing that remains, perhaps you will discover what I have experienced directly, that understanding the relationship with food is a direct path to coming home after a lifetime of being exiled. Perhaps that home is what God was always meant to be. Chapter 2, Ending the War. On the first morning of my retreats, I tell my students that the great blessing of their lives is their relationship with food. They look at me rather quizzically, but the sentiment sounds so lovely that they're willing to hear me out. Then I say that we're not going to fix their relationship with food. We're actually going to walk through the door of their eating problem and see what's behind it. Instead of using food to avoid discomfort, they are going to learn how to tolerate what they believe is intolerable. They stare. They scowl. They whisper to one another. Why would any sane person believe that tolerating the intolerable is a worthy endeavor? Mayhem is 5 minutes away. Then, because it seems like the thing to do, I tell them the struggling, suffering, hellish part of my story. Over the last few decades, I've discovered that stories of personal hell, sprinkled at tense and hostile moments, go a long way to diffusing bitterness. I describe the years of gaining and losing 1,000 pounds, loathing myself, being suicidal. Then I talk about the switch to not dieting and eating what I wanted to eat. I've told this story for many more years than I lived it, but it only recently became clear to me that the radical part of the tale is not that I stopped dieting, it's that I stopped trying to fix myself. I stopped fighting with myself, stopped blaming myself, my mother, my latest boyfriend for my weight. And since diets were my most flagrant attempts at fixing myself, I stopped them as well. I didn't care anymore that I was so fat I could only fit into one summer dress in the middle of November. I had reached my threshold of struggling and figured I had two choices: stop dieting or kill myself. Most of my students can't imagine a world in which they would stop dieting or trying to fix the size of their thighs. It is easier to imagine people coming back from the dead or Brad Pitt asking them to get married, than to imagine themselves dropping the war with their bodies. They have whole friendships built on commiserating about the 20 pounds they have to lose and the jeans that are too tight and the latest, greatest diets. They fit in by hating themselves, by trying hard and then harder to lose that last 20, 50, 80 pounds and never being able to do it. The never being able to do it is necessary if they want to fit in. The constant war with food and body size is important if they want to be loved. They are like Sisyphus pushing the boulder up the mountain and almost getting there, but never actually arriving. The great thing about being Sisyphus is that you have your work cut out for you. You always have something to do. As long as you are striving and pushing and trying hard to do something that can never be done, you know who you are. Someone with a weight problem who is working hard to be thin. You don't have to feel lost or helpless because you always have a goal, and that goal can never be reached. In an April 2007 UCLA study of the effectiveness of dieting, researchers found that one of the best predictors of weight gain was having lost weight on a diet at some point during the years before the study started. Among those who were followed for fewer than 2 years, 83% gained back more weight than they had lost. Another study found that people who went on diets were worse off than people who didn't. Failing is built into the weight game. There is no way to play it and win. I read these studies to my retreat students. I say, if you were ill and the doctor suggested a cure that would make you worse, would you follow it nonetheless? I expect them to say, of course not. I expect them to realize that they've been brainwashed by a $60 billion a year diet industry. Instead, at least one person says, you lost me when you got to the part about the summer dress in mid-November. Someone else nods. The general feeling in the room is that they'd rather be blind or paralyzed than wear a summer dress with an elastic waistband in the middle of November. If a full-scale war with themselves is what it takes to avoid being fat, if they need to keep blaming themselves and their mothers and their partners for their relationship with food, if their self-worth is increasingly shredded with every failure to stay on their diets, well, so what? Every war has collateral damage. During the first few days of a retreat, people are convinced that I have the answer to the puzzle of their lives. They really, truly believe that there is something that will fix their weight problems and thereby fix what they can't put into words, what it feels like to be them, to live their particular lives with their particular families, with their particular minds, what it's like to have insulin-dependent diabetes or a friend who was just diagnosed with breast cancer. They realize intellectually that losing weight will not take their friend's cancer away, but the promise of weight loss is that it will allow them to live on a magical piece of earth from which everything else will be manageable. One woman told me that it wasn't weight loss she wanted, but to feel lean and trim as if she wasn't carrying any excess baggage. Then she said that, oh, by the way, the love of her life had died a few years ago, and that the next man she got involved with died 3 weeks ago of a heart attack. But what I need most of all, she said, is to be trim and lean. I need that. I really need that. When I asked her how she felt about losing two people she loved within a few years, she answered matter-of-factly, I always get deserted. I always get abandoned. Always, I asked. Yes, she said, always. When I questioned her about the always belief, when I asked her about her feelings of abandonment, she said, I can't feel those feelings. They will wipe me away, tear me apart. What I need to focus on is being lean and trim. Then I'll be able to cope with all of it. In her mind, being lean meant being strong enough to deal with the messy feelings she didn't want to feel, with heartbreak, with loss, with being alone. If my body is in shape, which it never has been and probably never will be, then I'll be able to feel what I can't feel now. If I fix myself so that I am no longer myself, then everything will be fine. My feelings will be manageable. A student of mine said, if I stopped trying to be thin, I'd either eat so much that I'd take up two seats on the plane, or else I'd be so lost that I'd become a bag lady who sleeps on church steps. And while I have no doubt that using the relationship with food as a microcosm of our feelings about being alive actually leads to weight loss, I've seen it thousands of times, most people are still reluctant to end dieting and give up the war. From Courtney E. Martin in the Christian Science Monitor. So many perfect girls were raised entirely without organized religion, and the majority of the rest of us experience spirituality only in the form of mandatory holiday services with a big-haired grandmother. Overlay our dearth of spiritual exploration with our excess of training and ambition, and you have a generation of godless girls, raised largely without a fundamental sense of divinity. In fact, our worth in the world has always been tied to our looks, not the amazing miracle of mere existence. Women turn to food when they are not hungry because they are hungry for something they can't name, a connection to what is beyond the concerns of daily life, something deathless, something sacred. But replacing the hunger for divine connection with double stuffed Oreos is like giving a glass of sand to a person dying of thirst. It creates more thirst, more panic. Combine the utter inefficacy of dieting with a lack of spiritual awareness, and we have generations of mad, ravenous, self-loathing women. We have become so obsessed with getting rid of our obsession, with riding on top of our suffering and ignoring its inherent message, that we lose the pieces of ourselves waiting to be found beneath it. But fixing ourselves is not the same as being ourselves. The real richness of obsession lies in the ineffable stillness, the irrefutable wholeness that is found in turning towards its source. Like everyone else in this diet-mad culture in which we live, my retreat students are loath to stop the frantic attempts to change themselves. They know that something is not quite right in their lives, and because they are not at their ideal weights, they believe that food is the problem and that dieting will fix it. When I suggest that they're trying to fix something that has never been broken, a wave of anxiety courses through the room. They ask, "How could you say that nothing is broken when I can't fit into any of my clothes? When my husband won't touch me because I'm too fat? When I am out of breath as I walk up the stairs? Can't you see that something is terribly, terribly wrong?" And I say, yes, something is wrong, but it will not be fixed through losing weight. Since most of them have already been thin at least once, twice, or dozens of times, they already know this but keep forgetting it. The relentless attempts to be thin take you further and further away from what could actually end your suffering, getting back in touch with who you really are, your true nature, your essence. Arms are crossed, jaws are set. Ethereal anythings, essence, true nature, to the extent that they exist, can wait until they get thin. I say, can you remember a time, perhaps when you were very young, when life as it was, just the fact that it was early morning or any old day in summer was enough? When you were enough, not because of what you looked like or what you did, but just because everything was the way it was. Nothing was wrong. When you were sad, you cried, and then it was over. You were back to a fundamental feeling of positivity, of goodness, just because you were alive. What if you could live that way now? And what if your relationship to food was the doorway? In The English Patient, Michael Ondaatje writes, "A man in a desert can hold absence in his cupped hands, knowing it is something that feeds him more than water. There is a plant in the desert whose heart, if one cuts it out, is replaced with a fluid containing herbal goodness. Every morning one can drink the liquid, the amount of a missing heart." Compulsive eating is an attempt to avoid the absence of love, comfort, knowing what to do, when we find ourselves in the desert of a particular moment, feeling, situation. In the process of resisting the emptiness, in the act of turning away from our feelings, of trying and trying again to lose the same 20, 50, 80 pounds, we ignore what could utterly transform us. But when we welcome what we most want to avoid, We evoke that in us that is not a story, not caught in the past, not some old image of ourselves. We evoke divinity itself. And in doing so, we can hold emptiness, old hurts, fear in our cupped hands, and behold our missing hearts.